Dave Monk, Prairie Monk, WAFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. This is the Prairie Monk program, WEFT's weekly look at rails, trails, greenways, conservation, and ecology. And, oh, by the way, this is Sunday, July the 15th, 2018.
So my first topic today is salvage. This last day I walked past the dumpster way up high. And why is it way up high? There are salvage items in it. And this concerns me. First of all, we have styrofoam. So you have to... We're showing you this so that you can get an idea of the size. This goes to... dart in a banner if you're lucky, but it means someone has to take it out of the dumpster, remove the dry ice, and spend a couple of dollars getting it to a banner. It's very convenient. The dry ice is wonderful. It sublimates. and enables people to send things cold. It doesn't have the problem of water damaging the material. It's used for fruit and vegetables, ice cream, sometimes used by industrial people to freeze water so that they don't have to turn the water system off. They can block it and do a repair. There's just endless uses for dry ice. It's a compression of carbon dioxide, so it's available to industry, because there are a number of processes, including going from ammonia to nitrates to ammonia, or vice versa. You have a product there. There are industrial chemical flow lines where there is a lot of carbon dioxide possibility. There's also natural gas, and this can be compressed into and sublimated, and it sublimates about 100 degree minus, so it's much more much colder than regular ice. Sometimes used in medicine to do things like freeze warts, and not quite as good as nitrogen, which sublimates at a little lower temperature, but it's wonderful. But it could go to DART, you know, Banner used to be Solo Cup, and they compress it into chore it up into small pieces and compress it into blocks that I think are about 47 pounds, and then they can be shipped to Indianapolis or Chicago or St. Louis to a jobber. Sometimes they go overseas, and overseas makes use of the plastic. So that's my first one. The second one is a chair that's used by band people to sit behind the drums. And it weighs probably about 40 pounds. It's a substantial piece of equipment. Just the steel alone is worth saving. Why it should be in the dumpster, I do not know. There's a counterpart to it, which is another heavy chair. They're swivel chairs, these chairs. And can you photograph that?
It's on camera right now. For those of you at home listening live who don't have the benefit of the video that this will become, all of this is actually being held up so that the camera here can see it. So great sound effects, though, I have to say.
Now, this one needed people put their feet on the rung, you see, and people need that to put their feet on, but two screws were loose. I took it to the hardware store. We got the appropriate screws. It needs little pads on the feet that you haven't found yet, but that's a worthwhile piece of salvage. I usually take it to a Habitat or different places take different items. Now, right behind me is a This, I think, is a ramp for loading wheelchairs. It may be steel, it may be aluminum, but it's substantial. It probably weighs about 70 pounds or more. It has a handle for rolling. It seems to be something that could be reuse. Why this is in the Dumpster? I do not know. So, finding a home for these items takes time. And storing them takes real estate space. And you have to know the territory. There are some agencies that will bail materials. Sometimes I pull out of that dumpster after someone's leaving, having got a degree, 25, 28 shirts, all freshly from the dry cleaner, and somebody doesn't know or didn't want to know where they could get rid of them for reuse. Reuse is an alternative. But if you're a reuse agency, you also need to have someone who can repair a table that is missing two screws or a hinge or something. There's a limit to how much you can do. There's a limit to how much you can store. Most of the recycle agencies have a tag on their equipment. If it stays around for too long, then it gets to be garbage. This last week, there was a big piece of, perhaps not so big, but it was a set of shelves for filing letters and things like that. And it was mainly compression board with cardboard inserts, but I thought it was really something that somebody could use. But having been subject to some criticism for saving these sorts of things and moving them along, I let it go, but that goes to the landfill. And it's something that could be used. A lot of it has to do with attitude. Some communities do this very well. I kind of think from the contact I've had with people coming from other communities is, where is your recycling? So if private, you can do it. The city has good relationship with private people, apartments and things like that. But for commercial downtown, it seems like you can put anything anywhere. That same dumpster that I was pulling out of probably had at least 200 aluminum cans, and they go straight to the landfill. Just because we don't have a rule that allows a bar to have a place or requests bars to have a place where they can separate cans from garbage. Glass is a problem. Glass is not as an invasive because it's somewhat inert. So there are moves afoot to not preserve glass. But if you put all the glass in one mountain, in a few years' time, you can come back and salvage the glass, melt it, and reuse it. We're not at that sort of level. But people coming in from other cities often look to see where your recycling is. And we have lost recycling. We had a recycling center here. It started off with HIPS, Household Interested in Pollution Solution. And then it got to be a city-run recycling center, which was rather wonderful. Part of the urban sociology of this is that when you recycle, people meet with each other, they exchange. Often before the piece of equipment that you're recycling goes to the landfill, someone will discover it. So there's some recycling that way. And more recently, we had a dump area over by Prospect Avenue where Kmart was, and there were probably six or eight gondolas. Gondolas are just big recycling places, and they have doors on them so that if it rains, it doesn't necessarily all fill into the gondola. That reminds me that right outside right now is cardboard that I pulled out of a gondola that's associated with development. And the cardboard goes into the dumpster and goes right to the landfill. So here we're talking about, I would say, the steel. If I don't know whether the ramp is clean steel or aluminum. I have to put a magnet on it to see if it's which is what. But there's almost a couple of hundred pounds of material there. The cardboard goes into cardboard containers. It doesn't have to go to the landfill, and it can be recycled. Even if it gets wet, it can be recycled. Yesterday we had fairly solid storm in the morning, and there was water running everywhere, so cardboard gets wet. But it can still be manipulated and digested and used. Clothing can be recycled for wearing it again, or it can be baled and used in other things like tickets and things that need a little bit of strength to them. So that's there. Anyway, that's probably part of my rant. It's one of the things to do is to find out who can use it. So the ramp may go to someone like Kim Campbell, who is who brings trailers to town with honey and needs to load them on, load a small vehicle onto a larger trailer, and he uses ramps. But so it might sit around for a little while we figure out who can use that piece of equipment. If I don't find a person, I will send it to Metal Recycle at Max or Mervis, and it will be recycled that way. Somehow it needs a general feeling for recycling. The food is another part thing. There is, in some communities, it's almost a third of the food that's in restaurants and places like that gets to be thrown out. That food can be composted. We don't have a compost system. We don't have a system for incinerating materials that need to be incinerated. I have a whole bunch of teasel heads and reed canary grass heads and seed that should not go to the landfill to cause a mess at the landfill. So we need fairly desperately there an incinerator which will destroy those seeds that get in the way of our genetic preservation. So we need a drop-off center. The drop-off center over by Prospect was canceled because the city was putting in something like $175,000 to keep it afloat. And the problem is that communities around about get to know that, and they don't want to spend the money to have their own recycling, so it goes into the city. So how do you prevent that? It's very hard to prevent that. So the answer sometimes is to take out that center and not have it anymore. So where does the recycling go from Champaign? Does it go to Urbana, or does it go to other communities where they, in turn, are expecting others to pay the cost of the tax burden of keeping a center afloat? We need people who would repair. We have a lot of people who look for jobs and get some sort of excitement out of being efficient at recycling materials or cameras or computers or what have you. That means we need people who are technologically understanding of what is in the material. Is it worth preserving? We need economists who can look at it and say, this one doesn't work. We can't make money out of this. Let's let it recycle. In some communities, you have a bunch of people who sit around the community. This is mostly in undeveloped countries. And they sort the material as it comes in. That means you don't get the items that are bicycles or wheelchairs or items that can be recycled as is with a little repair. It's by that time it's been compacted and destroyed. So you're looking for salvage of metals and sometimes in here there are antique things and you have to know what old tools look like and whether people can use them. So we have a PACA, a Preservation and Conservation Association, which salvages from old buildings and recycles those, often very successfully, and we appreciate that sort of thing. There are people who buy old buildings in order to save them, and Chris Knight has just done that with the Solon building opposite the library. It's a big old building that's been sitting there for a long time, and Packer has owned it, but Packer has been preserving it. If you go out to the Sangamon River, there's a bridge sitting there, and Packer owns the bridge. There's no approaches and no off-ramps. It's a historic monster sitting in the middle of the stream. Can someone buy that as a historic thing? Are there groups that might take that into the future? Can people walk on it? Is it safe? It certainly is not useful for farm equipment, because the farm equipment is so big it can't go across these old steel bridges. But to have that old steel bridge is part of our history. Somebody has to protect it. It will acquire a tree or two coming down the river in flood time. So you have to make sure that the pedestals are not invaded by junk. So these things don't always just look after themselves. They need a team approach. There can also be courses. That places like Parkland College can have courses that range from antique knowledge to taking equipment and materials and preserving those materials and finding out how to redistribute them. And we need people who are in real estate who have the courage to have buildings that will house these sort of things so people can know where they are and come through. So there are a lot of recycling centers that we really respect. I just took 5 boxes of plastic cups to the Salvation Army. They support people who are homeless those places have food, and these are plastic cups that are still in their plastic covers, so they're sanitary. But there's a tendency for people to have an event, and at the end of the event, everything goes into the dumpster. It can be a street event where ice cream has been distributed, but it's got to be the end of the event and into the dumpster, not into compost, not into the sanitary system, which probably can use it because bacteria can enjoy a little ice cream here and there. Just so we need to generate a bunch of people who can do this sort of thing. Okay, that's enough of salvage. We'll put some additional pictures in because I think you ought to know what goes into the dumpsters, especially when students leave town. The YMCA and YWCA have gotten together and they have truckloads of furniture and equipment that can be stored for the summer until new students come back in the fall. And that is a really valuable service. And so if you have the energy, and sometimes you have to get two or three people to help you take a computer out of the dumpster, you have to be aware that technology changes very rapidly. So when you go from digital television, from a non-digital television to digital television, there are countless thousands of television sets that have to be dealt with. So the city two or three times a year has a opening for you to get rid of those sets. The recycling centers aren't allowed to do it because it doesn't give them any money worthwhile. The early sets probably had a little rare metals like platinum and gold and in contacts and things like that, but that's gotten so less that it doesn't pay to do this. So the city tries to deal with it. Right now we're dealing with phones. We want to go from landlines to Wi-Fi. That means you have to have a new box to take the Wi-Fi. And what happens to the phones? What do we do with millions of phones so there's a technology? So when we have an inspiration that a Play-Doh or a Mosaic or a Netscape or a change, we have to think about sustainability. What happens to the material that is left? That means that we need a bunch of people who know how to create a building that will be sustainable, can be taken apart in 100 years' time and the materials reused. Perhaps you unscrew them, perhaps you deal with them in such a way that a crane and a crashing material can take out the materials and recycle them. That takes energy right here and now. The biological community has to think about invasive species. If you bring in an autumn olive and it has nice little olives for birds and they spread them around, you've got a region with crud trees that take over and destroy your prairies and things like that. We also have to deal with those invasive creatures. So right now I could use some people to help slash teasel at Rantoul. And that's a biological problem. If we leave them to seed, they've got a million seeds. You have a seed pool for the next 10 generations. So we've been working at that for 6 years and spot herbiciding, and we would really could do with some help. In order to do that, you have to be a little bit organized. You have to have a number of people together to who can give you help. You have to have a pickup truck with tools. You have to have access roads. So it's not exactly simple, but it needs an attitude. Whether that attitude is at state or federal level or local level or in your own backyard. I'm pleased to see that people are growing pollinator plots in their backyard or in community situations, like the Second Street Dig has got pollinator plots. You have to have a kindly organization to make that possible. We want to remind you that the Big Dig is still in peak period for prairie, and you have cardinal flowers there that are nearing their maturity, but rather wonderful, and butterfly weed and purple clover and drop seed and iris or flag lilies in the wet places, and purple cornflower, yellow cornflower. And these have been put there by the city to remind you of your heritage. And we would like you to follow through on that. We've been successful in putting up a blog. For our first blog is a walkthrough of that area. We can probably improve on it a little, but that's our first attempt to have a specific item that you can go to and read. So places like the Banner Free Library and Parkland College and universities, Master Gardener, Master Naturalist, they're all significant attempts to remind you of your responsibility to nature and the world. We have to look at climate change, so there are people who are specialists who can deal with climate change and tell us what it's about and how species will move into new regions. And so we have to think about whether we're planting trees or we're planting prairie. Our area was 95%, 94% prairie, yet trees are of major concern. You can hug a tree, you can't hug a prairie. It's got chiggers in it, it's got ticks in it, but it's your native vegetation. We'll gradually do some blogs that make that more understandable. We're not sophisticates. We don't have a lot of details. We're dependent on places like the Natural History Survey to provide that sort of information, and they do it very well. So we're sort of on the applied side in downtown Champaign with a retreat that people can enjoy for other reasons, but then they suddenly find that there's also something about a prairie forest ecosystem. We talk about it and people come back, and that's going to change. Recently, our pocket prairie has been replaced by a beer garden, but the pocket prairie has gone to Second Street, and it will add to the biodiversity of the already planted sidewalks of prairie plants, and they spill over onto those sidewalks, and that's interesting. Okay, I'm looking at the time here. Some of the things that we did this week included what should we do in a broader sense. I've spoken some about regional planning, but we have Kickup Through Trail that's been very, very successful. It's wide enough to take out our vegetation, which is a little disappointing, but otherwise we're rather pleased. That's 7 miles of a 25-mile strip of rail trail opportunity. If you look in that direction, the excitement that you get by going to in the direction of Danville and Indianapolis is a little more restricted than if you go to the west, where you have a Clinton Power Plant Lake, you have Allerton Park, you have the Sangamon River, you have more attractions. So we're working to bring in historic trains. There's a Champaign, Havana, and Western Railroad, and it's 5 years old in its establishment as a not-for-profit agency. But what we have to do is re-rail 4 miles of land between Whiteheath and Seymour, and then we hope to maintain or retain the railroad bed between Seymour and Bonneville, so that we can gradually urge our way into Champaign. And then you have to think about, where can you stop? Where does the city have open space? You have thousands of people downtown in apartments, but where do they exercise their interest and enthusiasm about the overall landscape? How do you teach informally? Well, that means you need little places like Westside Park or little nooks on the corner of a street and places like Pocket Prairies. It's amazing the educational value, the informal educational value of that. We look at buildings. There's a possibility that we'll lose the character of Market Street because people need more apartments. And so there's a move afoot to have the building that's opposite Weft retained as a building, with the character of the street that was. This was one time a fairly raunchy street, and people knew that, and it was also prone to fire. And so how do you encourage that sort of retention of something that is old? It'll give an opportunity for people to dream and enjoy. They've been painting the facade of the building across from Weft, a different building. It'll be a bar, and I just appreciate the fact that the tin rather than masonry has been painted, and new windows have been put in. And I suspect strongly that they will have an environmental impact, in that they will be probably two or three pane in nature and help to preserve the apartments that are upstairs, or will be upstairs. We're not anti-development, but the world has too many humans, and you can't keep growing your national product by saying we need more people to use more equipment or materials or food or whatever, and you can't keep doing that forever. There has to be a point where there's sustainability, where you go a little slower and you keep the biology of the world a little less invaded and utilized for a short period, whereas the biodiversity says that we're looking at 10,000 years or even millions of years. How do you value that butterfly? How did the butterfly get there? How did you get there? How do you relate to the butterfly? We need to know how to live frugally which means not so much upper crust. We need people who can share at a more modest level, and that's not something that most countries regard highly. The aim is to use your resources and to make money doing that. And, so we need people who are educated in the whole principle of sustainability and economic development with modesty. We've been looking at the possibility of transferring 33 miles of railroad bed to a land trust. We've been glad to be around to initiate the Kickapoo Trail. Lots of other people have been involved in putting that into action. A lot of the things we do initiate. They don't necessarily. We hand over to other people that can do things more efficiently. Our breadth is great, but our specialty is not so great. So that trail has been developed. It's in the control of the Forest Preserve and the Vermilion County Conservation District. And those two groups are designed to make the success of that trail that is. The next step will be from St. Joe to Ogden, and I'm looking for that to be slightly narrower so that we preserve some of the nature that's along there. There's a fifth-end depot for the interurban that was parallel, and that has been preserved locally by local people who have a regard for that building. We're talking about ties for that were used in that area to drop in between ties so that people wouldn't freak out by heights. There are some of those materials left over. They've been parked in the front of Kevin Green's house, and they've been there for the best part of 20 years, and we would like to use them in the railroad reestablishment between Whiteheath and Seymour. And eventually that is going into action. We will be able to pick up those ties and reuse them. But overall, we're talking to a Land Conservation Foundation established by Bruce Hannon and a bunch of people around him, Paxton and Bullard and people who came in from out of town and prevented the formation of a Oakley Reservoir. So it would have sort of destroyed a lot of Allerton Park. So Bruce has been continuing that sort of thing, and their foundation is the sort of foundation that has name people, people who have expertise, like Fran Hardy, who has been a regional director for natural Department of Natural Resources, who is now Nature Conservancy. We have people who are prepared to buy a chainsaw to remove autumn olives. We have a land that is adjacent to Allerton Park, so if a foundation took it over, they could, if an emergency, transfer it to a body such as Allerton Park, which is owned by the university. We have three on one section between Monticello and Cisco. We have three trestle bridges and culverts. And those areas are slightly wetter than the mesic land that's on the railroad bed. And so you have some wetland species, and they rise up to the areas that are on either side of the creek. That means that this is valuable territory. It's been disturbed by railroad creation, railroad use, railroad maintenance. But on the other hand, this is some of the only soil that's been relatively undisturbed. It has a lot of the species that are valuable. It includes a rattlesnake that is endangered. It's in Illinois, it's the eastern Massasauga rattlesnake. And so it hasn't been seen lately, but at one stage, a Massasauga was run over and identified. And Allerton Park has those creatures. They weren't brought in by Allerton. They were there, and they're still there. So that makes that 4 miles rather valuable. Can we start off by looking at that 4 miles? And to some extent, we have to be cognizant of the fact that people want something that is done now. 20 years ago, 30 years ago, when we bought the Hirtland Pathways land, people were thinking they were going to have a trail in 10 minutes. Didn't happen, folks. It wasn't going to happen. What we were doing was gathering up land when it would never be available again. If you're going to retire a railroad, it's not going to come through it, in that location at least, between Clinton and White Heath. There are spots of land on that corridor, and Shady Rest is one of them, 30 acres of land that was platted for community development, but it never happened. But it's alive with species. So eventually that's gone to the Piatt County Forest Preserve, and it will be there in perpetuity. And people like Fran Hardy have worked to have it registered as a natural area, so it's protected. So how do we talk to the land trust? Well, I've been talking to people individual as individuals. Part of this is a family establishment. You have to understand each other. Often you have a slight difference of opinion, but basically you're looking at the same objective. And so you need to get on with each other so that you can understand each other's limitations, and surprisingly, you get together by doing that. So talking to each other is, for us, tremendously important. Having pieces like the 4 miles between Monticello and Cisco that could be, in inverted commas, developed, how do you develop it? Do you have a tandem truck to run along it? What do you have to have a foundation that does that? Do you work with the state? Does the state do that? Sometimes the state doesn't have much money right now. The Illinois Department of Natural Resources does not have not much money. So then it would be propitious to have a foundation that not only cared for the Sangamon River, but might have enough get up and go to have a place of retreat, a place of office, a place where people can know where they can go, a place where you have a workshop where you can do things, put up signs. At one stage, the road that goes parallel to the railroad line that we've preserved, that was always not always, but mostly roads followed railroad lines. So the three culverts that covered three drainage basins suddenly were improved. And the contractors that did that decided that they could bury their old culverts on one of our wetlands and or in adjacent wetlands. And that was a little bit cruel because it's taken out a number of species that we cherished. So if you were to give or transfer this right-of-way to a land trust, would they have the ability to work it? Or do they find other groups like the Grand Prairie Friends that might take it over in perpetuity? Grand Prairie Friends has done very well in Coles County especially. A little by happenstance because they got some donations there, and so that's taken them in that direction, and it's taken them in the direction of forest restoration rather than prairie. But they still have prairie involvement. So could you transfer this real estate to a land trust, and then can the land trust transfer it to others? Is this something that you can see in your lifetime that is something that's developed? One of the big problems with the Kickapoo Trail was that it was delayed for 20 years, and then the question was when there was the lowest bid was higher than expected, then the community had to be asked to contribute. It had to be decided who would be, what agencies would be the respective owners and caretakers. So forest reserve and conservation districts. How do we do this? It's slow. It takes perhaps 50 or 100 years to look and see that we have a need for a regional planning office, so that you look at our coal and where we're losing 30 miles of land that's some of our own only remaining prairie. And there's a Bloomington Trail coming in from Bloomington to Farmer City. There, the rails are being moved, removed this very week. How do we have a region of people who network so that you can have connectivity between these areas for bicycles and hikers? And how do we get it together in, say, a 10-county area? It might be a downstate area. It's done very well in the Chicago area where the Open Lands Project and other projects, too, work and advise the city, the state, the region as to what they can do. And they do it so well that they are respected and very well funded by people who believe in this sort of thing.
5 minutes.
The Nature Conservancy has some of the same sort of thing. George Fell got together with early ecological people and created a Nature Conservancy, and then he got involved with Illinois Nature Preserves Commission. The listing of 13 different ecosystems in the state, and a research center, and that continues, and it is especially continues in different states that have different subgroups of the Nature Conservancy. So Chicago area has money and it has clout, and it has a lot of rail trails and greenways that we don't have in the downstate, because downstate has been very oriented to the value of the land adjacent to railroads. The only place where we find our prairies is along railroad beds and in dead cemeteries that haven't been mowed for a long time and haven't been destroyed. So there's a whole nother group of politics that we have to deal with and that is the mowing community. We mow, and that takes out the creatures and the connectivity and a whole bunch of other issues that need to change. So people invented their rotary mower, and now we have bush hogs that go everywhere. But not everything likes to be mown and dug up for economic gain. So we have to think about, again, whether we're aim is to acquire money or acquire sense. And if we're going to have genetics around for any time, then we have to concentrate on sense rather than economic gain.
Three minutes.
Yes. I want to say we will add this week again the blog that we've put together. We may modify it just a little bit. We don't have a lot of time to do this sort of thing. David is a volunteer. I'm a volunteer. We really can't spend a lot of time putting these things together. So our efforts are often rough and tough. So if you understand that, you can have a walk through the Big Dig. You can see our little plot of prairie that used to be the pocket prairie. And yes, we need your help. Just weeding the pocket prairie. We've disturbed the soil, so all the disturbance creatures are there. So the weeds are there. We need people who know what a velvet weed is, what a ragweed is. There's two species of ragweeds, a small one and a large one. We need a signs that will say what we're doing and why. And it needs to be neat and tidy enough that it makes a statement and makes people stop and be interested and help. So we could use your help, especially at the moment, slashing the teasel that we haven't been able to have time to spot herbicide. And that means you're going to try and remove the heads that has a huge rosette, which takes out all your prairie plants, of leaves at the ground level. So slashing doesn't necessarily destroy the plant, but the concern is for the seeds that it produces, and the seed heads are getting ripe. They are wonderful as far as a dried arrangement is concerned, but they are a murder as far as preserving a prairie. So we have to, in the long run, we might enjoy to get the dried arrangement people to not use this rather interesting teasel, which used to be used to tease wool because it's got nice little spikes. So if you can go with a machete and take off those spikes, just let them rot on the ground, we would be very, very pleased. And you can do that without us having to be looking over your shoulder. We will introduce you to what our problem is, and then you can help. And so think about that. Just being in the parade was very helpful. I have to thank Lisa Fay for driving the van with some indication of what these places look like. So it's time. This is Dave Monk, your Prairie Monk, WEFT Champagne, 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board. As always, the views and opinions expressed here are solely those of the speakers and no one else. Dave has mentioned his vlog, his video log showing the Big Dig and how the pocket prairie plants have moved over there. If you go to YouTube and type in the